Hello, and welcome to this FRDH, First Rough Draft of History podcast. I'm Michael Goldfarb. In the middle of April 2024, the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza expanded as Hamas's overseers, Iran, entered the fray with a massive launch of airborne ordnance at Israel on April 14th. 5 days later, Israel responded with a swat of the back of its hand rather than a full-scale retaliation. World War III, the more hysterical corners of the internet asked. When I want calm analysis, I turn to Stephen Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. But before we begin, I want to remind you to visit the website, www.goldfarbpod.com, and make a donation so I can keep the podcast going. Now, I began my conversation with Stephen Cook by asking him his view on the Iranian attack.
It seems clear where the Iranian attack wasn't necessarily the symbolic performative attack that some had suggested. The Israeli one seems to be. The Israelis have used apparently glide bombs to attack essentially two Iranian air bases. I think in response to the Iranian effort to attack Nevatim Air Base in Israel, which is where Israel has most of its F-35 fleet. So it's done some damage. The Israelis proved that they can penetrate Iranian airspace, and Iran's air defense system did not work. And so the hope is that this was enough of a demonstration of Israel's technical proficiency that the Iranians will stand down. I think the complication is, one, the Iranian foreign minister was on CNN a half an hour before this all happened, saying an attack will be met immediately with a response and a devastating response. And it seems that he and others who are coming into power in Iran are a younger generation of IRGC personnel, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps personnel, who seem to be particularly hardline. And so we don't know whether this will be the end of it. I think that is what certainly the White House and the Europeans are hoping. I understand that the White House got advance notice of this. There was no participation from the United States. So we shall see what we shall see. But I think the dangers of an escalation spiral remain. We won't really know whether we're out of the woods here for, I think, a number of days or even weeks.
You know, that's interesting. I mean, in this week, the focus has been Israel-Iran, and the whole world has an opinion on it. And I always think there's a lot of empty space. Two large countries with quite a bit of desert between Israel and Iran. So when we talk of war, what are we talking about?
I think that's an excellent point. I don't think people realize that Saudi Arabia is the size of the United States east of the Mississippi River. It's a very big country. And then you have Jordan also, which, you know, people think of Amman and it's a small population, but it's actually quite large landmass wise. The expectation that there would be some sort of land war is kind of absurd. What we're looking at is basically an updated version of what happened during the Iran-Iraq war, where there's a war of the cities where they lob missiles at each other. And that's kind of what we're seeing. The Iranians have essentially fashion their forces in that way, have very significant missile forces. But as we've seen, not sophisticated and vulnerable to Israel's multi-layered defense. And the Israelis have some ability through both their air force drones, sub-launched missiles. It's going to be interesting to see where these attacks actually came from, since the Saudis and the Emiratis and others in the Gulf have said, please do not use or traverse our airspace in order to attack Iran, believing that they would be attacked in response. So there's a lot of questions, but yes, this is a sort of each country lobbing ordnance at each other over large distances. So it is a war of sorts, but not a war like we think about it.
Israel does already have capability. Going back a decade, Israel has been able to assassinate Iranian scientists allegedly working on a nuclear weapon for Iran. Go back 15 years, Israel inserted the Stuxnet virus into Iran's computer systems working on designing a bomb. So there's a reasonably successful program to keep Iran inside its box without igniting regional conflagration.
It's a really good point, and there was a fair amount of effort taken during the Obama years to keep the Iranians off balance and to co there was cooperation between the United States and Israel. Stuxnet was a joint U.S.-Israel operation in which they inserted malware into the Iranian nuclear program. They've done that actually a number of times. The Iranians apparently have increased their capabilities and are engaged in fairly sophisticated cyber attacks on Israel and Israeli systems at the same time. So there is an ongoing conflict in cyberspace between the two countries. But when you listen to, for example, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commander, General Hossein Salameh, he said, "We are interested in changing the equation with the Israelis." And I think you have to take that very seriously and take him at his word. And I think actually October 7th and a lot of what has happened since then is part of that. Up to October 7th, the Israelis really had their way in the shadow war that the Iranians and the Israelis were conducting against each other. The Israelis would undertake airstrikes in Syria and Iraq, engage in these cyber attacks, assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists, heist Iranian, nuclear data, shut down gas stations in Tehran, and so on and so forth. And Iranian responses had been generally weak in response. Now, it may very well be true that the Iranians were unaware of the date of Hamas's attack on Israel, but certainly played a role in preparing and training and financing Hamas in this. And what you see unfolding since is that Iranian proxies have put pressure on Israel on four or five fronts. And I think when you think about the Iranians trying to respond to the shadow war and change the equation with the Israelis, I think the last 6 months, as well as including the attack on Israel last weekend, I guess it was April 14th. Is they're all part of this effort to change the equation in the region.
What's your view of the united front of US and France and Britain, Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia? Is that a new alignment or a one-off, just a one-off to deal with a particular circumstance that was telegraphed in advance?
It's hard to know. The United States, particularly the Biden administration, although it's predated the Biden administration, but the Biden administration really picked it up. Has worked very hard on developing an integrated air defense system that included all of the countries that were involved in the in repelling the Iranian attack: the Israelis, the United States, European allies, Gulf countries, Jordan, Egypt. This has been a signature effort on the part of the Pentagon and U.S. Central Command, and it worked. And there has been, I think, broadly speaking, genuine interest on the part of Arab countries of being part of this integrated air defense system, given that how vulnerable their cities are to Iran's fairly robust missile and rocket forces. It's important to note, though, that after the attacks on Israel, the Jordanian king, King Abdullah, was very, very clear that he was defending Jordanian airspace, not Israel. The Saudis said they had no role in, I think, no role in intercepting Iranian drones. Now, that leaves open a whole other range of things: radar tracking, real-time information to the US, the Jordanians, the Israelis, those kinds of things. So I think that there is a genuine effort to have this and it not be a one-off event. Of course, the horrifying war in the Gaza Strip is something that's complicating matters for the Jordanians and the Gulf states. The proof of concept, though, will be if the Iranian foreign minister was true to his word that the Iranians will respond. And how could they respond other than in a similar fashion? They don't have other capabilities, unless, of course, they throw Hezbollah into the fight. That is a dangerous prospect for them because, one, the Israelis have a lot of technical capabilities. I do think the United States might get involved with a Hezbollah attack on Israel. And degrading Hezbollah essentially degrades Iran's second strike capability and leaves its nuclear program vulnerable to Israeli and possibly American attack. So they're left with few options other than a repeat of what they did on April 14th.
So, should Israeli partisans in Britain, where I am, and the US, where you are, should they be a little less concerned than they were at 11 p.m. Eastern time last Saturday night? I mean, I just happened to be in the US last week when the attack was launched.
No, I think to some extent that's right. Of course, the Iranians could, double the amount of projectiles that they send in the direction of Israel. Would the multi-layered defense system work in those circumstances? It's certainly true that the Iranians now have a fairly good idea of how this integrated air defense system works. Are they proficient enough to figure out ways around it? So there are dangers absolutely remain, but I think one of the reasons why there was so much triumphalism on social media on Sunday was that the worst was avoided by 99% of incoming ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones were shot down. So I think there was a huge sigh of relief on the part of Israel's friends in the United States, the Jewish community, the evangelical community, others, and so on and so forth. But I took to social media and said, look, I don't think we're out of the woods yet. We don't really know what's going to happen next, how the Israelis are going to respond. Do the Iranians have another response? So this is a real issue. This is a new configuration of confrontation in the region that I don't think everybody previously thought was theoretical and is now actually our reality.
Well, we'll come on to Israel and Gaza eventually, I promise. But what's your read on the internal politics from the street in Iran? I mean, we get constant reports of the people being deeply unhappy with the regime, and you need to have some support to pursue a war.
I actually think it's quite hard to tell. Remember the massive demonstrations after Mahsa Amini was killed by the religious police. And there was a thinking among, a fairly significant and influential part of the Iranian expat community in the United States and Europe that the revolution was on and that the regime was on the ropes. But then the regime was able to mobilize large numbers of people and gather itself and put down what was essentially a fairly significant uprising. I remember arriving in Abu Dhabi in the midst of it and asking people, asking Emiratis, asking Saudis, asking Iranian dissidents who were there, is this it? Is this it? And they said, no, the regime is going to win. And this was in the middle of it. And I said, really? Because there is this general sense, at least in Washington, that this is a moment that could go actually either way. And they were very, very confident that the regime would win. They had an insight into the Islamic Republic that I think at a distance, it's very, very hard for us or Iranian expats to gather. I do think that the regime has certainly lost its ideological support, but it is, and so it really is kind of like a typical authoritarian state that uses massive amounts of violence against a portion of its population and can still mobilize another part of its population. We do know that what was happening simultaneously to the exchange of fire between Iran and Israel was that there was a big crackdown on women who were not covered. And there are these, you can see it on social media, the police beating the crap out of young women and arresting them for not being covered. But again, I feel like I've learned my lesson any number of times here that these things are just by their nature uprisings where it one of the keenest observers of Iranians' domestic political scene anywhere, a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace named Karim Sajapour, put it this way: the regime can fall tomorrow or it could fall 30 years from now. So we don't really know. And that's something that is not satisfying to anybody at all. But I think that's the closest thing, closer to reality than saying the regime's on the ropes or.
Maybe Netanyahu could fall tomorrow or in 30 years also. I mean, his father lived past 100, but okay, we might as well go to Israel and Gaza. The inciting incident, October 7th, which started this terrible war, which brings pressure into other countries, especially the United States, in an election year. What's your read on the current state of play?
Well, I think that the war grinds on. I think that there remains significant support in Israel for Israel's overall war aims, which is colloquially to destroy Hamas. I think to render Hamas unable to threaten Israel's security is probably a more realistic view. And it sounds like it's splitting hairs, but it's not. I mean, you know, the United States, we didn't destroy ISIS, but ISIS is not an existential threat to the Iraqi state at this point. There, Israelis, while everybody is concerned about escalation between Iran and Israel, the Israelis are continuing airstrikes in the Gaza Strip. There's a horrific airstrike just the other day that killed children. The Israelis continue to promise that there'll be a Rafah operation. There is more humanitarian aid that is getting into the Gaza Strip, but humanitarian aid workers have been saying it's not just the number of trucks that are going in. There's a whole kind of infrastructure of humanitarian aid that can't be set up in Gaza because it's a free fire zone. So the situation remains terrible. There's really very little prospect for a ceasefire. Hamas remains defiant. And from their perspective, I'm not defending them. I'm just saying that from the only bargaining chip that Hamas has are the hostages in the Gaza Strip. And they refuse to give them up without getting a commitment from Israel that the war is over. And that undermines, if the Israelis were to agree to that, that would undermine their war aims, a war aim that, you know, two-thirds of the population supports. So we're at a standstill. The Qataris have been coming in for more and more criticism from American politicians and Israeli politicians. And the Qataris are threatening that they're going to walk away and wash their hands of the mediation. I'm somewhat doubtful about that. The Qatari mediation is a source of their power and influence in the region. So, but the situation in Gaza remains overall horrifying and terrible, and there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. And this is precisely what the Israelis said. I think two things that the Israelis said from the very beginning are fairly consistent with what we're seeing now. One, this would take many months. And two, they're not interested in entertaining these kind of diplomatic solutions to the problem. What Ron Dermer said, I think, in November, that Israel intends to have overall security control of the Gaza Strip, I think, is the likely outcome, as terrible as that sounds.
You know, I've been racking my brain thinking of any comparable situation in modern history where you have this kind of asymmetrical warfare, where a terror group or insurgent group has embedded itself in a population, attacked a bigger state with a much better organized military, and was totally defeated. And I just can't. And with the endless video of each incident going like wildfire around social media from those under assault, and with vengeance still being the prime motivator for many Israelis and Jews in the diaspora, can you think of any incidents of an outcome that might work at the end of this dreadful process?
Barry, this is something that I have been thinking a lot about, because Washington is... it's raining day after plants, and that everybody's seeking to be very influential with their plans for the day after. And every one of these that I look at, and I don't mean to be the hanging judge here. It just don't seem to work on a political level. So you know, the idea that people are building on the Israeli idea of working with Gazans. That's, you know, local Gazans, not Hamas affiliated. But that presupposes that you actually can kill every single Hamas guy who's not going to turn around and start shooting at collaborators, who they perceive to be as collaborators with the Israelis. Now, those people may be armed as well, but then you turn this whole Gaza into like warlordism, you know, a mini Afghanistan, so to speak. There isn't a plan that I've seen that is workable. And that's why I take the Israelis very much at their word that they will maintain overall security control over Gaza, which is basically a return to the status quo kind of on steroids, where they widen the no-go zone. They ring Gaza with with air defense systems, and they don't stay out. They use the freedom of action to go after targets of opportunity. And then, of course, you have, 25 to 30% of the Israeli public who supports resettlement in Gaza. The hard right, the settlement right, is pretty substantial. And what they're saying is, we didn't have this problem when we had settlements in Gaza. And that argument is a more potent political argument now than it was in 2005 when they said, if we pull out, we're going to undermine our own security. Now that their security has been undermined, people are saying, hey, maybe that's not a bad idea, at least within the settlement community, which are core constituency of this government. Just getting back once, so that's, I don't really see these grand plans. I mean, maybe I'm not creative enough, or maybe I'm too cynical, but I don't see how this all works out. People say, well, you have to free Gaza of Hamas in order to move towards a Palestinian state. I can get behind that, but how do you actually free Gaza of Hamas after all of this time? It's deeply rooted there. And with Israeli tactics, such as they are, you may get Hamas 2.0 or what have you, given the extraordinary violence that has been applied to Gaza. And I think one of the things that the Israelis have done, the intentionality of this violence, is to demoralize the population, and so that they would essentially give up.
I think of Mosul in northern Iraq, a place I've visited many times, and I have friends who lived there. And in the end, what did they do? They said, well, we've got this problem with ISIS, and they took one of the most important and beautiful cities in all of the Arab Middle East, and they leveled it.
Yeah, I was there. I mean, UNDP was just starting to rebuild it, but it had been reduced to, I mean, it wasn't the entire city, but the western part of Mosul was basically leveled.
And I said to this to people on October 8th, if the goal is to eradicate, if the only way to clear Hamas out is to do to Gaza what they did to Mosul, and in Gaza that won't be possible because of civilian casualties, and sooner or later someone close to decision-making in Israel has to say, we can't do it.
Well, I think that there are some voices that have been raised in Israel, not that we can't do it, but the way in which the Israelis have gone about doing it, that the military campaign has been deeply flawed. Gior Island, who's a former general and someone who is a public commentator known very well in Washington circles, has been deeply critical of the way in which the military operations have unfolded. But he isn't, at least to the extent that I know, he hasn't said that the overall goal is unattainable. I think there's some consensus in Israel that they can actually destroy, excuse me, they can destroy Hamas. And he's not alone in suggesting that the military operations were flawed from the start. But nevertheless, here we are. And it does not strike me that what the United States has said should happen, what the Arab states would like to see, at least publicly, the administration, there was news this morning in Washington that the administration would make a big push on Saudi-Israel normalization by dangling a deeper, wider, more detailed defense pact with the Saudis. The Saudis would normalize the Israelis in turn for getting that gift, as long as the Israelis, there was some significant push, I think were the words, significant push towards a Palestinian state. Well, define that. What does that actually mean? And so I actually don't think that that's a serious thing, but I think it's a Hail Mary pass ahead of presidential election season getting really into high gear. I hate to say it, but there's not a silver lining here.
I don't want to ask you about Rafah and the possibility of what would happen.
I think it's going to happen. Reports came yesterday that the Israelis and Americans were meeting virtually, and that the Israelis had come up with it. When the last time there was a virtual meeting between the Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer, who's also the former ambassador to Israel, and the National Security Advisor Tzaki Hanegmi, with American officials, with the American National Security Advisor and others, the Americans said, you don't have a plan for Rafah. Come back when you have a plan. And apparently, in this meeting, the Israelis had a plan. And there were some reports that there was some jockeying over, you know, Iranian a response to Iran for a Rafah operation. But of course, they responded to Iran anyway. But this is a live conversation. The fact that there is no imminent operation against Rafah doesn't mean that there's not going to be one. We're on the eve of Passover. I don't think that the religious parties that are supportive of Netanyahu want to disrupt Passover. I'm not being tongue-in-cheek about that. I think that that's a serious thing. But there's been no indication that the Israelis are going to heed American warnings about not doing Rafah.
All right, this is too depressing. I want to move to another subject. We gaze at our navels. What happens in the Middle East, because it involves the U.S., Europe, and the oil-producing countries of the Middle East, is the most important thing, right? But you've just been in Hong Kong. How is this situation seen from East Asia?
In Asia, from the Chinese perspective, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. The United States is bogged down, you know, hurting partners and adversaries alike in the Middle East, trying to avoid a regional war, which means that there's less attention and less resources being paid to the Taiwan Strait. And I think that that's important. I think sometimes the Chinese, I mean, I'm not an expert on China. I don't speak or read Mandarin, but these are my impressions from being, and of course, Hong Kong is a different place, but not as different as it used to be. I've been there before, and there was definitely a different vibe to the whole thing. And I did speak to people from the mainland. I think that the Chinese are often surprised at the American strategic errors in the Middle East. That, you know,
what would they consider a strategic error?
The invasion of Iraq. I mean, I think that that's something. But I think also getting involved in trying to remake societies in the region, that somehow we had the power to do that. I think their approach is, we don't want to get involved in any conflicts, any disputes. We basically are after one thing, which is the free flow of energy resources out of the region, which quite honestly is quite similar to the way in which the United States started out in the region. And we lost our way after the end of the Cold War, when we began this kind of ambitious effort to transform the region. And so I think the Chinese are kind of dumbfounded that we would even go down this road, but are more than happy to have us wrapped around the axle in the Middle East rather than focusing our attention on what we now call in Washington the Indo-Pacific.
Well, now, you've got a book coming out shortly, and it's available for pre-order even. So what's it called?
The End of Ambition: America's Past, Present, and Future in the Middle East.
Well, it seems pretty ambitious at the moment.
Well, you know, actually, it's interesting. Everything that the United States is doing in terms of supporting Israel in its helping to ensure Israeli security and working to keep the Red Sea open, and those kinds are perfectly consistent with how American policymakers have defined what's important to the United States in the Middle East. And so these are things based on the analysis in the book that are not unexpected. They're contested by lots of people, but nevertheless, over the years, we have identified the free flow of energy resources as the prime directive. And with that comes the freedom of navigation. And then second, helping to ensure Israeli security. And then third, American predominance in the region to ensure those two other goals. And so this is sort of consistent with what we had done, you know, particularly beginning in the 1970s, all the way up through the end of the Cold War. The argument in the book is that we were pretty successful in doing that. There were moral costs of it. We supported up authoritarian country leaders who spilled blood. We spilled our own blood in the pursuit of that kind of authoritarian stability. There was obviously the moral cost of support for Israel at the expense of the Palestinians and justice and dispossession of the Palestinians. But given those were our defined goals, we were successful in meeting them. The problem came at the end of the Cold War and after the the successful defense of Kuwait in 1991, where the United States essentially stood alone in the world and sought to leverage its power to remake the Middle East. From the Clinton team, they sought transformation through peace, that if there was peace between Israelis and Palestinians, the rationale for the national security states of the region would fall away, and it would pave the way for a more democratic, open, prosperous Middle East. Bush flipped that on his head. George W. Bush flipped that on his head and said, no, 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 the way to peace is through reform. Again, trying to transform societies of the region. And we got ourselves all bollocksed up in this. The return on the investments in Iraq, in peacemaking, in the freedom agenda were, I would say zero, but I'm tempted to say less than zero. The costs were so great. And so what the book is arguing is saying, look, the Middle East remains important. The restrainers, the people who want to withdraw from the Middle East, they've got it wrong. We actually can be in the Middle East and be constructive, but we have to think about using American power to prevent bad things from happening rather than leveraging American power to try to make good things happen. Now, trying to make good things happen is sort of like a nice thing. Americans want people to live in prosperity and democracy and so on and so forth. But we don't have enough insight, knowledge, resources to remake other people's societies. So we're better off just trying to prevent bad things from happening and hoping that the region, goodwill, people of goodwill in the region will transform their societies themselves. That's the best that we can do. And maybe we can be constructive out of it at some point. But I think that where the administration is falling back on old habits is by saying, okay, now we're going to revive the Palestinian Authority, and then we're going to take the Palestinian Authority and we're going to extend its authority to the Gaza Strip, and then we're going to get all these Arab countries to rebuild the Gaza Strip, and then we're going to make this big push for a Palestinian state. That's unlikely to work. That is leveraging American power to try to make good things happen. And I think we're asking, the record in that is a failure, and I think we're asking for more failure when it comes to that. I do believe that senior officials understand that this is a pie in the sky kind of thing.
I just want to go back to a point that we skated by earlier about some of the stupidity regarding the conflict. That is the U.S.-Israel relationship. I always see Israel less as a client state, although in many ways it is, but the Israeli defense establishment, in the broadest sense of that term, is also a huge research and development arm for the Pentagon. I mean, feel free to disagree with me. It's my podcast, but you're an expert. I try to explain it really isn't about American weaponry going one way. It's a much more complicated relationship than the U.S. having the Jewish state's back in a rough neighborhood.
I think that that's right. I think also, let's just be clear about something, and I'm anticipating a criticism from my book in which I talk about Israel being a secure country that is not vulnerable like it was in its early years. And I maintain that. Even after this terrible 6 months, starting with October 7th and the kind of four or five front conflicts that the Israelis are confronting, had the Israeli senior command listened to the 19-year-old women who sit on the border and watch video screens of specific sectors of the Gaza Strip day in and day out, to the point where they get to know the people and their habits, 9 hours a day watching these video screens of what's happening into the Gaza Strip, and they were reporting to their senior commanders, there's something brewing here. They're planning a major attack on Israel. We would not be having this conversation had the senior commanders not blown off these young women. We would be talking about Saudi-Israel normalization for real, not some kind of notional bank-shotting it off of a two-state solution and a defense pact, whatever. That it's something that would be happening. So I may take the Israelis do have the capabilities to secure their own country with American help. And there's been a lot of American help over many, many, many years. And not just in the defense field, in basic science and technology, the two countries have collaborated together. Most of the benefit has really run in the direction towards Israel, but there's been benefits to the United States as well. One of those is, I mean, if we're going to talk about defense articles, is Iron Dome, which was developed and deployed by the Israelis. And then around 2012, the U.S. Army said, hey, that's pretty good. We could use that to protect our forces. And American defense contractors invested in it, and now Raytheon is a partner with the Israeli manufacturer of it. Most of the aid, there's a huge amount of U.S. military aid that goes to Israel, is an open question and something I raise in the book, whether that remains necessary. But a huge amount of that aid is spent in the United States. In fact, there was a carve out that allowed Israel to spend part of that aid money in Israel. That's coming to an end, and it all has to be spent in the United States. All of this is to the benefit of the security sectors in both Israel and the United States. And that's why the way I put it is the United States helping to prevent threats to Israeli security. There's help there, but there is a genuine partnership there, and the Israelis may look hopelessly dependent on the United States at the moment, but it was just a problem of political and military leadership that we're looking at it in this way of dependence on the United States.
Right. Well, the problem of political military leadership is the essence of the conflict, isn't it?
It is. And very often when you talk about things as intelligence failures, it's not intelligence failures. I mean, remember the July presidential decision briefing, presidential daily briefing, July
2001,
Bin Laden determined to strike the United States. Now, I saw the declassified version of it. There were things that the CIA and the FBI had gotten wrong, but the top line, as they say, was Al-Qaeda is intent on striking the United States. They blew it off. Or they didn't get it right. Same thing in Israel. This intelligence failure was not, they had the intelligence. They didn't act on it for a variety of political reasons, inherent biases, and so on and so forth.
And in Israel, it's the other way around. It's well documented now that Netanyahu has been prime minister for more than 95% of the time since 2008 and was playing Hamas off against the Palestinian Authority, classic divide and rule, conveying cash from Qatar, bags of money from Jordan across Israel to Gaza.
Incredible, right? And what's even more incredible about it is the Israelis, you know, they like to tell you, we live in this region, we know this region, we understand it better than you naive Americans, and so on and so forth. Yet, riding the Islamist tiger is something that Hosni Mubarak tried. It's something that any number of countries in the region have tried. And it has always come back to bite them. And so you would think that the Israelis would have understood from their neighbors that this was not a way to go. Yet they did. I mean, there's all kinds of misinformation out there. You know, the Israelis created Hamas and so on and so forth. That's untrue. The fact that Hamas changed its charter and now accepts Israel's right to use, that's untrue. But the fact that the Israelis believed that Hamas was interested in getting fat and happy and wealthy in the Gaza Strip, and that this was going to be a way, and they could ride that to divide the Palestinians further so there'd never be a Palestinian state, was a miscalculation. Because when you ride the Islamist tiger, you get bitten.
Stephen Cook, thank you very much.
I really enjoy these conversations. Thank you.
And the worst of it is, this situation is going to go on, and I'm going to call you again in a few months.
I'm always happy to chat.
And that's all for this FRDH podcast. My thanks again to Stephen Cook. The title of his book is The End of Ambition, America's Past, Present, and Future in the Middle East. And a reminder, there's now an FRDH, First Rough Draft of History, Substack. Slightly different kind of content, and you can also make a donation there, so I can continue to do this work. Thanks.